that's where we grow. It's in the middle. Middle to nowhere.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Middle to Nowhere, where we explore personal journeys of faith, spirituality, and things like inner work and yada yada. I'm Taylor Blanpede, and today we're going to unpack some of the things that I learned from these last two episodes, where I had the great fortune of getting to have conversations with some of my old friends, Jonathan and Leah. And later in the episode, we'll dig into some insights that I've gained about repairing my beliefs a little bit by examining the original intentions behind some biblical text stuff, specifically the word sin. So let's get to it. Yeah, so a lot of beautiful insights came up for me in my conversation with both Jonathan and Leah. For Jonathan, it was just really interesting to hear his story of growing up without a religious upbringing. His parents, you know, didn't go to church. And it wasn't until later in high school that he, you know, started going to our church. And just hearing his story where we started seeing he started seeing the differences that came up into his life after being introduced to the church culture. You know, it's a unique situation to see how his personality was kind of already formed, you know, being in high school without it, and then getting to see the changes that were introduced after. You know, we talk specifically, we're using the term for his inner shame monster that was created, you know, where he was kind of doing this interesting juxtaposition of, like, he would go to Jesus camp over the summer and, you know, have these really powerful experiences, you know, during worship and being in this church community, really for the first time having a big sense of belonging. You know, but then, you know, within the same summer going to Ozfest with his dad and, you know, going to these concerts where, all sorts of, things are going on that he now started to very much so judge and, you know, had all this kind of internal, struggle going on. And, the shame monster grew to where he was starting to judge his friends, for, you know, the thing, you know, they were just still, they hadn't changed. It was, you know, it was Jonathan that's changed. And instead of continuing to love his friends in the same way, he started judging them and he started judging himself. So it was just really interesting for me to see kind of that genesis of this, you know, quote unquote shame monster that came into his life. And, you know, I think when, before talking to Jonathan, like I've struggle with kind of the idea of guilt and shame, like, I don't know, my whole life that I can remember. But I think when you grow up in something, you just kind of assume that that is what everybody thinks until you start asking people or you start doing some research. So it was really a big aha moment for me to realize, like, so much of that really came from being exposed to that kind of purity culture and that church culture that it just seeps into your psyche, especially when you're young. And, you know, my aha moments only became, you know, more focused and more specific in episode 7, where I got to talk to Leah about her journey of deconstructing her faith and leaving her church. And, you know, she has really done a lot of work. And I'm just so proud of both Jonathan, and Leah, but very specifically for Leah, you know, she had still been in the church for a long, long time, much longer than me. and was just sharing so much of the pain that of just that feeling of lost time. You know, it wasn't until she was in her 30s that she even started to date somebody, and before she, you know, really decided to live her own life. So if you miss those episodes, I would really highly recommend, because it's just this, all this stuff comes up in a really beautiful and organic way. But yeah, there's a lot. The more and more, you know, those conversations were really just kind of an opening or an invitation for me to look further into this and look further into myself and start connecting the dots on the struggles that I've had throughout my life, and connecting the dots to some of the things and some of the culture that I was exposed to. And yeah, I mean, it's a lot, I'm realizing, to be subjected to an intense purity culture in something that you're spending so much time on. And, you know, what we talked about with Leah was, you know, this, the term, a high demand religion, where, you know, so much of your extracurricular life, if not all of it for some people, is completely spent in the church. It's not just going to church on Sundays. You know, it's, you've got your life group at some point during the week. If you're in the worship band, you've got practice, and you also come in early and play for multiple services. You have early morning prayer. You've got, you know, prayer room nights, and, you know, it, the list goes on. And that's not even getting into, you know, going on mission trips and doing Jesus camp and all sorts of other things. But yeah, the more and more research that I've done on this, it just really shows, like, these issues don't just let themselves go when you leave a church, or even, you know, like me, when you leave the faith, especially if you're raised in it, and even more so if you've had actual instances where you were shamed by others, or especially by leaders, for your actions, or where you were made to feel like you needed to really show penance for your sin, getting kicked out of the worship band, having to publicly apologize to people. There's all sorts of stories from myself and from lots of other people of things like this, where that shame just really gets further ingrained. And yeah, especially for women, I've found, you know, talking to Leah, it really, she just very well articulated just what it's like to be a woman in that culture. You know, she's talking about how she was, you know, taken aside to, hey, you can't even wear like sleeveless shirts because your shoulders were too tempting. Because, yeah, I mean, in that culture, girls are really seen as these quote-unquote stumbling blocks to men and their relationship with God, and it's their job to keep, you know, the men of the congregation from stumbling into sin, or, you know, thoughts of lust or whatever, you know. And so I've really just gone back further into my mind and really kind of done this whole time machine journey, going back into memories and stuff. And, you know, we had done the True Love Waits program. This is like an abstinence program where you literally signed a purity contract to not have sex until you were married. And, you know, you had bought a purity ring that you wore and all this stuff. Yeah, I remembered that I had a purity ring that had like the crown of thorns on it. I got it from James Avery. It was real cool. But yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot here. I found a really good article in some of the research that I was doing. It's titled "How Evangelical Purity Culture can lead to a lifetime of sexual shame. This is an older Vice article. It looks like it's about 5 years old. But it talks about, it's kind of introducing a book that was written by this writer named Linda K. Klein. The book is titled Pure: Inside the Movement That Shamed a Generation of Young Women and How I Broke Free. It looks like a really, I was kind of checking out the book. I haven't read it, but it looks really cool. I'll just read the quick summary. In Pure, Linda K. Klein uses a potent combination of journalism, cultural commentary, and memoir to take us inside religious purity culture as only one who grew up in it, and reveals the devastating effects of evangelical Christianity's view on female sexuality has had on a generation of young women. And so it talks a little bit about some of the things in the book in this article, and it shares a specific personal story of this woman, Linda. I don't know if she goes by Linda or Linda Kay, but apparently she had left her evangelical community and her church in the early 2000s. And it says that it was at this point when she started to begin to consider to have sex that some of these physical symptoms started. It talks about a time that her and her boyfriend started to become a little bit sexual, and basically she would have these breakdowns where she was in tears and she would scratch herself until she bled and ended up, you know, in the corner of the bed crying. And let's see, it says specifically about the book, it says, a 12-year labor of love. The resulting book is an eye-opening blend of memoir, journalism, and cultural commentary that masterfully illustrates how religion, shame, and trauma can inform one another. Citing medical studies, she lays out that evangelical adolescents are the least likely to expect sex to be pleasurable and among the most likely to expect that sex will make them feel guilty. And in comparison to boys, Klein observes, girls are 92% more likely to feel shame, especially girls who are highly religious. And for many women like Klein, that shame can manifest into physical symptoms. And so she cites a lot of different stories of other women, how they've literally had like these physical manifestations of this shame, and how these symptoms very much so for a lot of people, even people without the physical symptoms, a lot of these types of behaviors can resemble people who have experienced PTSD. They have higher anxiety disorders, borderline personality disorders, can result in depression, sexual difficulty, and negative views about the self. So, interesting. I may eventually check out that book, but yeah, just something I wanted to throw out there. But yeah, it's been quite a rabbit hole, to be honest, in a good way, but a little bit overwhelming in some, to just realize like there's a lot of strings attached to this kind of growing up in this culture. But it's been really good to see how some of the things that I still struggle with, I'm seeing some strings attached to what I experienced. So some of the things that I've realized, obviously, like the more obvious one is the shame and guilt. You know, people who were raised in this carry a deeper sense of shame and guilt about specifically their sexuality, but you know, feeling that any sexual desire or activity outside, you know, these prescribed norms is, you know, just so inherently sinful and disgraceful. And, you know, it's interesting for me because it's like, you know, I think, you know, like I was saying a little bit before, it is, I think I just thought that when I left the church and when I left that belief system or a lot of the beliefs that were kind of tied to the shame and all that piece of sin, that it would just kind of go away. But it's still interesting how some of this stuff can still come up. It's kind of embarrassing, but like, I just the other day was meditating alone in my office. And for some reason, this is the first time I decided to meditate naked. I don't know if I thought it would somehow be more organic or something, but it was so difficult, to get into the meditation. I was so distracted and I eventually had to like cover myself up, with my shorts. Like, and I realized thinking about it later, it's like, that's kind of weird to have that like level of, I don't know, shame just about my own body. And so, and this is, you know, me being a white heterosexual male that is married now, and I still, you know, have some of these tentacles of this shame over, you know, body stuff. So I really just have so much compassion, especially for the you know, girls that grew up with this and now women that I'm sure, you know, based on these studies and stuff, especially just carry so much of this shame over their bodies. Just really sucks to know that. But, you know, the further studies and stuff that I've looked into, you know, obviously you have your like fear of intimacy, like the article was talking about, but a lot of self-worth issues can be very tied to sexual purity. You know, when you have these like super high standards that not everyone can hit, like you just have this sense of inadequacy and it really starts to take a toll on your self-esteem. You know, you really do start to view yourself as damaged goods if you've, you know, quote unquote, fallen into sin, or especially if you had to confess and you go through this whole thing. You know, I very much so felt this kind of like damaged goods thing. And like, even though there was so many teachings about God's grace and love and forgiveness, like there was just always kind of this sense in me that like, it was kind of, I don't know, almost like a genie that can only grant so many wishes, you know? And like, even though I did feel like God had forgiven me, you know, each time that I needed to ask for forgiveness, I think it was just kind of the feeling that I got from this, the leaders of my church that I had this, these situations with, but like, you just feel like you're not quite redeemed. And each time something would happen, it was like a layer of, you know, like a layer of like worthiness was stripped away, like with each, you know, sin confessed. And over time, you know, I think I unconsciously started to see God that way, you know, started to see Jesus as someone who demands perfection. That, oh, maybe I am just damaged goods, and what would, you know, God want with someone like me? And, you know, through researching this, this relationship with religion is a really big thing. You know, people who experience shame and guilt very much so leads to a complicated or strained relationship with their faith. You know, definitely the religious community, but it definitely causes or can cause spiritual disillusionment. And for me and for many others, just a complete departure from, you know, organized religion and even from any sort of belief system, which is hard because, you know, like we are spiritual beings, even if it, like I didn't have to completely leave everything. I mean, not that I'm like sitting here in regret or anything, but, you know, I think because that view of yourself seeps into how God views you, It is like you just want to walk away from the whole thing. But some other interesting things that I've connected the dots on is also I very much so struggle with perfectionism. It's something that I've known for a long time. And I've learned that this is a common thing for people who grew up with this, you know, this high level of purity. It fosters these perfectionistic tendencies because you feel like you have to be flawless in all of your behavior in order to be accepted and loved. Because, I mean, it's not even just the physical manifestations of, you know, sexual sin or whatever sin. Like, so much of what is taught is about your thought life. You know, there's verses about even, you know, thinking about having sex with someone is just as, you know, like it was taught that that's just as bad as doing it. Obviously, the way that it was, the response in the community and stuff, it was clearly not the same thing, because if you actually did it, it was like a very big deal. But yeah, that perfectionism is something that I would love to talk a lot more about, because there's a lot of really interesting kind of tentacles where it can hit a lot of different places. Because I do feel like I just, you know, I've struggled with this idea that I have to be perfect in everything I do in order to be loved. And I see myself in that same way, that, you know, I have to get everything right. And whenever I do make a mistake, it's like I beat myself up so bad, or definitely historically. And, you know, just, should have known, I'm so stupid. Instead of just seeing it as like, yeah, you learned from your mistake, and now you can take that, what you've learned, and, you know, move forward. Another thing that can come out of this is that is very obvious that we see is just judgment and legalism, especially for people who are still in that culture. You know, for people that say they love Jesus, and supposedly adhere to his teachings, it very much so develops this judgmental attitude towards others who, you know, if you don't adhere to the same standards that we're living in, then you're the problem. You know, you create this legalistic mindset where adherence to rules is valued over compassion and understanding. You know, like, how would Jesus respond in this situation? Nothing like what we're seeing, especially, you know, with the election coming up and all this stuff. It's just, it's really sad and disheartening sometimes to just really see the amount of people who say they love Jesus that just are so judgmental, so hateful, just so nasty. It just sucks to see. It's just sad. But another thing that can come up later in life is anxiety and depression. You know, the internal conflict that comes up, it's similar to this perfectionism stuff, but like when you don't meet these standards, it leads to a lot of anxiety. This constant battle between these conflicting emotions can take a mental toll. You know, this kind of pattern that's created of always judging yourself, having this like ever vigilant eye, like this, like visualize, you know, Lord of the Rings, the eye of Sauron that's always, you know, watching and scanning. And, you know, it's that eye is not nearly the same scary thing that it used to be inside my head, but there is this pattern of just kind of always questioning what I'm doing, always like worrying about what I'm up to, and like if I'm doing the right thing, it's more so kind of under the guise of the direction of my life and kind of this idea of having a purpose in life and God's purpose. And there's a lot to honestly unpack with the topic of God's plan for your life or the idea of purpose. And I'll dig further into that, I'm sure, because it's something that I struggle with a lot, of constantly being afraid that I'm like, whether or not I'm on track, you know, with my life, or if I'm doing enough, if I'm helping enough people. And that just doesn't need to be there at all. Like, I have a good heart that wants to help people. Me worrying about if I'm doing enough, it only gets in the way of me doing that. And I know that that's the same with so many other people that had a similar background to me. So, yeah, there's a lot to this, and I'm only scratching the surface right now. So, yeah, when you are growing up in a church like this, you know, often feeling that heavy burden of guilt and shame, every mistake, every wrong thought or action, you know, was seen as a sin that separated me from God. This sense of inherent wrongness was ingrained in me from a very young age, and it has taken years and will continue taking time to unravel it, I'm sure. But I feel pretty good right now. I feel like I'm coming closer and closer. It's been really cool to understand some of this stuff. But did you know that the original translation for the word sin in the Bible simply means to miss the mark? In researching this, the Hebrew word chata and the Greek word hamartia both carry the idea of missing a target, just like an archer whose arrow falls short. So this perspective shifts the focus from inherent guilt to simply not hitting the ideal or intended outcome. So that made me like question, when I started learning this stuff, like, how did this original understanding of sin as missing the mark transform into a source of deep shame and condemnation? So to understand this, you know, I had to research the history of biblical interpretation and theological development. So here's some backstory that I found that I think will be helpful to those of you, if you haven't, if you don't already know this stuff. So, yeah, let's dive into it. So, during the early Christian period, theologians like St. Augustine of Hippo, he died around in the like mid-400 AD, I think. So just to give you kind of a timeline, like, he emphasized a lot of human depravity and the need for divine grace. He openly talked about the need for shunning people who fell into sin. And Augustine's views on original sin and human nature laid the groundwork for seeing sin as inherently shameful. This perspective was further developed during the medieval period, where the focus on, there was a huge focus on penance and things like confession and the sacramental system. All that stuff like reinforced this association of sin with guilt and shame. And then a little bit later, if you fast forward to the Puritanical movement, this was in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, the Puritans emphasized personal piety, you know, really strict moral codes, and the fear of divine judgment. Their influence in early colonial America deeply ingrained the idea of sin as something to be feared and avoided at all costs. You know, and for those of us who grew up in Texas in the 90s and 2000s, if you remember, we all had to read the Scarlet Letter in high school. It's very good description of kind of what we're talking about here. And if you fast forward a bit to the Great Awakenings movement in the 18th and 19th centuries, this further intensified this view. And you have like these revivalist preachers like Jonathan Edwards with his famous sermon. It was titled Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. He used all of the classic fear-based tactics to compel individuals to recognize their sinfulness and to, you know, seek salvation. So, yeah, you know, this fear-based approach continued into the 19th and 20th century, like the evangelical movements, which, as we know, very much so emphasized a lot of, you know, repentance from sin and this purity. But something that I found that was interesting, and I've talked about this a little bit before, but it was cool. You know, if we return to the original meaning of sin as simply missing the mark, we can see a parallel in the Buddhist traditions. In Buddhism, you know, certain behaviors are described as skillful or unskillful. Unskillful, you know, not being anything like inherently bad or shameful, but just, you know, kind of just like the original meaning in the Bible of sin, it's just missing the mark. So, you know, this means that like our quote unquote sins are simply the things that aren't helpful for us living our most, you know, actualized selves. Or you could say, you know, it might just get in the way of us living our highest potential or with the most loving and open hearts. So, yeah, this is kind of a big thing, at least for me. You know, seeing this, and it's just kind of like, I don't know, part of me just feels a little bit upset. That's like, it feels like all these, you know, these saint hippos and, you know, people in these medieval times. And I know that there's so much documentation and writings about how the Bible was used historically for coercion of a populace, you know, make them obey, make them be fearful for not only their lives now, but for what's even better, to control people is to make them fearful for all of eternity. So I won't get into all of that historical stuff because there's just no way it would be one episode, but yeah. And so I think, you know, I'm talking about kind of repairing some of my own beliefs. You know, I don't know if I will return to the, you know, solely to the Christian tradition, but I definitely feel like I have space for all this stuff right now. And to, you know, include the teachings of Jesus and to look at the Bible as the you know, beautiful doctrine that it is. There's so much good to it, especially when you sift out some of these translations that introduced all this shame and just so much hurt for a lot of people. So, you know, when looking at sin as just something is missing the mark, like, it kind of makes me ask the question, like, what if we viewed our shortcomings not as a source of shame, but as opportunities for growth? You know, what if missing the mark was simply just part of the human experience, a chance to learn, to adjust, and to try again. So, you know, it makes me wonder, like, how would today's, like, let's say if sin is simply missing the mark, the target, how might this idea change how today's Christians see the world and how they treat themselves? And so I feel like every episode now, at least episodes I do on my own, I have to at least have some sort of conversation with ChatGPT. So I asked ChatGPT, if sin is simply missing the target, how might this idea change how today's Christians see the world and how they treat themselves and others? So it, in all of its wisdom, said the following. Embracing the idea that sin is simply missing the mark could potentially lead to several transformative shifts in how today's evangelical Christians see the world and treat themselves. Oh yeah, I put evangelical in the question. So number one, reduced shame and guilt. Duh. So viewing sin as missing the mark removes the heavy burden of inherent guilt and shame that often accompanies traditional interpretations. Instead of seeing themselves as fundamentally flawed or sinful beings, individuals may recognize that mistakes and shortcomings are part of being human and can be opportunities for growth and learning. Number two, compassionate self-reflection. Rather than condemning themselves for their perceived sins, individuals might approach self-reflection with compassion and understanding. They can acknowledge where they may have missed the mark without internalizing it as a reflection of their worth or identity. Hey, that would be nice. Number three, focus on personal growth. Understanding sin as missing the mark shifts the focus from fear of punishment or divine wrath to a constructive focus on personal growth and development. It encourages individuals to strive towards living more aligned with their values and spiritual beliefs rather than living in constant fear of falling short. Whoa. ChatGPT struck again on that one. Yeah, I mean, honestly, that really resonates with me a lot. This really, you know, shifts the perspective from just obedience to, you know, and living your life out of just not wanting to sin or, you know, to not want to burn in all of damnation, but to really just focus on all this is personal growth. And I won't go into my full rant about how so many Christians would rather worship Jesus than follow his teachings, but I feel like this very much so taps into that. So I won't go into all of the rest of them, of what ChatGPT said. It says, you know, four, emphasis on grace and forgiveness. Five, openness to dialogue and understanding. Actually, this one's really good. It says, this perspective can foster a more open and inclusive dialogue within evangelical communities and beyond. It encourages listening to diverse perspectives and interpretations of religious teachings, promoting understanding and empathy rather than judgment and exclusion. Just what we were talking about before. And the last one says, six, integration with psychological and emotional well-being. Recognizing the human aspect of sin can support better integration with psychological and emotional well-being practices. It encourages individuals to address feelings of guilt and shame in healthy ways, such as through therapy, mindfulness, and self-care, rather than suppressing or denying these feelings. Yeah. All of these things sound so much more healthy and balanced and loving. And yeah. So as we wind down in today's episode, overall, embracing the idea that sin is simply missing the mark has the potential to lead to a more compassionate, growth-oriented, and spiritually fulfilling approach to life and faith for anyone in the Christian belief system or others who resonate with this perspective. It could promote a healthier relationship with oneself, with others, and with the divine, fostering a deeper sense of peace and authenticity. So, as we reflect on our own experiences with guilt and shame, let's consider the possibility that these feelings are not what the original teachings intended. By embracing the idea that sin is simply missing the mark, we can begin to heal and move towards a more loving and understanding view of ourselves and others, and maybe not judge people for doing things like going to Ozfest. Thank you so much for joining me on this journey. If you have any thoughts or experiences that you'd like to share, please reach out. I'm on Facebook. My stuff is out there. Let's continue this conversation together. I will see y'all next time, but until then, remember, it's okay to miss the mark. It's all part of the journey.